higher dimensional quantum. Like Peter Salinger's talk, because it's not very similar to Peter Salinger's talk. The inference is purely superficial. Right, so. So throughout this talk, I'm not going to talk about Hilbert spaces. I'm going to talk about one Hilbert space. So you can see what's going to come. So whenever I say one Hilbert space, I'm in an ordinary Hilbert space set, which is a vector space which is in the product which is complete. And also throughout this talk, everything is going to be totally finite dimensional. So I'm not going to say the words finite dimensional. So I say group, I mean finite group. If I say Hilbert space, I mean, if I say one Hilbert space, I mean finite dimensional one Hilbert space. Having said that, pretty much everything I say should generalize to infinite dimensions. This isn't a sort of mathematics that has to be purely finite dimensional. You just have to be a bit more careful and subtle with the way you state things. So it makes it simple just to keep the finite dimensional case. Right, so what are one Hilbert space? They're sets with extra structure. But for a while now, people have been interested. So mathematicians and physicists have been interested in things called two Hilbert spaces. There's a list of some physicists who've thought about them, mostly in the, almost exclusively in the context of quantum field theories, abstract approaches to quantum field theories. And mathematicians have been interested in them for other reasons. Right, so these aren't sets, these are categories. And I've got that extra structure, just like Hilbert space is a set with extra structure. Well, I'm going to give you a bit of an introduction to these things. I'm going to tell you why you should care about them, what's the point of them, why they're useful, what they've got to do with physics. But I'm going to argue something else that they should actually they're telling us something about quantum mechanics that people haven't really got to grips with yet. They tell us something about quantum mechanics in quite a fundamental way. Right, so first is the most important motivation for why, if you're a physicist, you think describing the universe is important, you should be interested in higher Hilbert spaces, like two Hilbert spaces. Right, so what's a topological quantum field theory? Well, a topological quantum field theory is like a quantum field theory, an ordinary quantum field theory, but it's one that doesn't depend on the metric on our manifold, so it's only sensitive to topological properties of the manifold. So that doesn't sound awfully physical, and it isn't the real, although there are examples that we think should be relevant to physics, such as in topological quantum computation, for example. Proper quantum field theories, which are sensitive to metric structure and so on, it's also very much expected that these should be able to be described using two Hilbert spaces and so on, in a way that's very analogous to how we describe to you. But it's just much more complicated and we haven't got there yet. So the only reason people study topological quantum fields, the theories, is that they're easier, basically. But there's no sort of a priori reason why high Hilbert spaces should be relevant for more realistic problems as well. Okay, so let's just have a quick look at what topological quantum field theories do. If they're n-dimensional, then the most important thing they do is for a closed manifold, so an entire universe with no boundaries at all, so a totally closed universe, assigns a complex number. So you could think of that, people do, as the amplitude for this universe to occur in that particular way, okay? Under this field theory. But it also does something else. It assigns an ordinary Hilbert space called the n-1 manifold. So you can think of these like space-like slices for our universe. And this is something we're used to in ordinary quantum field theory. If we have a space-like slice, we associate a Hilbert space. That's the state space for the quantum field living on that hypersurface. But there's something you can do in topological quantum field theory, although people haven't worked how to do it yet, in ordinary quantum field theory, is you can keep going down in dimension. So if you're working with a four-dimensional quantum field theory, then four-dimensional manifolds will be assigned complex numbers, three-dimensional submanifolds, one Hilbert spaces, but the n-2 manifolds should be assigned higher invariant, so in this case a two Hilbert space, a category. And in fact, this should go on, there's nothing special about two. We should be able to go as high as we like if our topological quantum field theory is fully local.
What's the significance of closed here? Just tell me.
So a topological quantum field theory also assigns things to manifolds which aren't closed, but then they're like it will assign a map between two Hilbert spaces, or a map between. So this is just the simplest sort of assignment.
The closed is the topological notion.
Right, so it just means that, so like this manifold here hasn't got any boundaries. The map is walking around loops before.
Are you taking this as your definition of fully local?
So a perfectly valid way to define fully local is that a TQFT or any quantum field theory is fully local if you can. So you can do what you usually do in field theory, since it was before, talking just the top two steps,
yeah.
But you can also go all the way down as well.
Yeah.
But there are other ways that you can spread fully local. Okay, so that's the motivation for why two Hilbert spaces should be seen as important mathematical quantities. Right, but not only are two Hilbert spaces important to use to describe these quantum field theories, they're just as important as one, nothing special about one Hilbert space at all from this perspective. So then it's a little bit peculiar that the way that we understand quantum theory is completely in terms of one Hilbert spaces. Our interpretation of quantum mechanics, the formalism that we use, the way we talk about self-adjoint operators and all this sort of stuff. This is clearly directly wedded to the specific mathematical structure of Hilbert spaces. But the point of this talk is to persuade you that the mathematical structure of one Hilbert spaces isn't anything particularly amazingly special or unique, and it changes, but maintains its elegance as you instead look at the mathematical structure of two Hilbert spaces and three Hilbert spaces, and new and interesting things arise. And it all fits together in a very nice way. And so based on the TQFT point of view, I think we should really take these things seriously and try and extend our techniques. So that's the sort of thing that's going to be a thrust upon what I'm going to talk about. Right, so these are a few things that we're happy to do with conventional quantum theory, with one Hilbert spaces. But how on earth would we talk about these sorts of things if we were looking at a submanifold of our universe on which the fields didn't have a state space, a one Hilbert space which is a state space, but a two Hilbert space? Well, I certainly won't answer all these questions, so I'll talk about something.
Why would you? I don't see the point. This is quite different conceptual setup now. Why would you want to describe a solid evolution measurement on two Hilbert spaces?
Well, so from my perspective, looking at this hierarchy, which is something that many people believe should be, you should be able to extend this to a real physical quantum field theory. I'm not sure about quantum gravity or anything. That's going another step further. But from this perspective, there's absolutely nothing special at all about ordinary Hilbert spaces. Okay. So to say that this is the way that your quantum field theory is presented, and then say, but the way we interpret our quantum mechanics, the way that we talk about measuring our quantum fields, the way that we describe our observables, all just lives at this level, and we have nothing of equal magnitude to say about the other levels. It just seems like your interpretive framework isn't really living up to what the mathematics does.
There's also time to ask what's the direct physical evidence for this picture. I mean, certainly a nice mathematical.
Right, so that would be more of a mathematical talk that I could give rather than So to talk about why we believe that physical quantum field theories should admit this further description is certainly a very sophisticated mathematical question, which I know a little bit about, but certainly wouldn't tend to be. Which you're an expert in. So one thing I can say about that is that as people study topological quantum field theories, some topological quantum field theories only live at these top levels, and they can't. I'm not going to get to the end of my talk, am I? So some topological quantum field theories can only be described at the top levels, and they just can't. Some can go all the way, and some can go halfway, and so on. And if you look at the ones that, can, be defined all the way to the bottom of this hierarchy. They're the ones which you can describe in a very local way. Okay, so the word local there. I'll describe what that means. So one way that that's very concretely can be interpreted is by a triangulation on your manifold. So if you take your manifolds and you cover them in syntaxes and triangles of different dimensions, depending on the dimension of your submanifold, and then you define your quantum field theory by looking at this formalism called the state sum formalism, which basically involves imagining little sort of particles interacting in the vertices of your triangulation. And then you sum over, so you do a sort of Feynman sum type operation, and you sum over all the ways that all the particles can interact on this triangulation that you define. If your TQFT is one of the ones that are defined in that way, then it can be fully extended. And that is the way that we think of real physical quantum field theory. So, this stuff is difficult to work with, and all of the only concrete arguments that exist at the level of topological quantum field theory rather than more realistic. So that would be a more physical argument. But of course, to back that up, then I'd need to show mathematically why that's correct. Probably it's outside the scope of this talk.
Calculation. You involve the entire level of the first and the bottom of the graph. So I just forgot. It's getting there anyway.
Some people might need stronger motivation than that for recasting anything. No,
well, I'm not saying we recast anything this afternoon. Maybe we can do that early 9:30 stuff. Okay, right. So, well, we're all very happy with that then. So let's put it on to slide 3. Right. So, I'm going to give a very concrete, practical introduction to two Hilbert spaces. And in a lot of ways, they're incredibly similar to ordinary Hilbert spaces. You just need to make a small change in perspective, and then a lot of things that are true, a lot of statements you can make about Hilbert spaces, you can also make about two Hilbert spaces just by switching number one to number two. Okay, so the simplest two Hilbert spaces, Hill, which is the category of Hilbert spaces, so that's a nice sort of symmetrical thing going on there. So Hill, the category of Hilbert spaces, that is the one-dimensional two Hilbert space, okay? So that's a little bit strange to get your mind around that the first time you see it, maybe. But it's a category, it's objects, finite dimensional Hilbert space, and we'll continue to think in that. And then in italics is the statement about ordinary Hilbert spaces that we should compare that to. The simplest 0.01 Hilbert space is just C, the complex numbers. So some people like to think of C as a zero, the couple numbers as a zero Hilbert space. Right, so let's go on, right? So in fact, every two Hilbert space. Remember, we're restricting finite dimensions here, but every two Hilbert space is in this simple form. It's just a finite number of copies of the one dimensional two Hilbert space. Right? And we write this as Hilb n. Of course, you can compare this directly to the familiar fact that every one Hilbert space is just a number of copies of complex numbers. So it seems that nothing new really here is happening. We're just adding together categories to add together numbers. So there's a nice definition of two Hilbert spaces, if you know this category theory. So they're the Cauchy complete Hilb enriched categories. And in fact, that's a mistake. That should say Hilb dagger categories. So not only do you require your categories to be enriched over the category Hilbert spaces, but you want your category to have a dagger functor, which gets along with the dagger functor on Hilb by the enrichment. And Levere defined a notion of Cauchy completeness for enriched categories. And you can use that, Bruce Bart used that to show that two Hilbert spaces are exactly the Cauchy complete Hilb category, which can be compared sort of nicely to the familiar statement that Hilbert spaces are Cauchy complete complex n product spaces. So the metaphor breaks down there a little bit, but it's still fun to think about things like that. Right, so how do you obtain two Hilbert spaces? So this is getting an important point. So, in fact, the first two Hilbert spaces that people ever developed, they obtained them in this way by splitting groups. So every two Hilbert space can be obtained by finding the category representations of some group. It's also true if you say this. So I'm not quite an logical structure. But we'll get on to more complicated things of that. And so you should compare this to the state that every one Hilbert space is a set of representations for a set. Right now, people get to talk about representations of sets very much. So a category of representations of a group sort of foxes in the group, the category of Hilbert spaces. And we'll use them, we'll see this in more detail later, but hereby representative of a set, those are all the functions from the set into the complex numbers, that's the analogous thing. So there are lots of things that are true about Hilbert, two Hilbert spaces that are also true about back from the world of one Hilbert spaces. So hopefully that should persuade you that two Hilbert spaces aren't particularly scary. Right, so we've talked about what two Hilbert spaces are, and now we'll talk a bit about what the maps are between two Hilbert spaces.
Was the significance that you're taking those functions into their wrap of things, functions into the unit object?
So all I was saying there. The category of representations of a group can just be seen as the collection of functors in your group in the category of Hilbert spaces and vector spaces. Right? And the equivalent statement you would make about a set, if you want to talk about a set of representations of a set, you could just define it as the space of functions from the set into the complex numbers, functions on the set. And this will be, if S has got mod S elements, then this will just be the Hilbert space T to the S.
Three and five, yes.
Right. Right. Two Hilbert spaces are categories, so maps between them should be functors, and they are. And just as maps between Hilbert spaces are one Hilbert spaces are forced to be linear, so also we want maps between two Hilbert spaces to be linear. Okay, so all of our two Hilbert spaces just look like Hill to the N, N copies of the Hilbert spaces, and an object in it would just be an n-tuple Hilbert spaces. So we write it like this, just as a vector. And of course, Hilbert spaces, so we just define dimensions, and Hilbert spaces are justified by their cardinality, an actual number, zero, or a positive integer. So we can just really take this definition of this x to just be a column vector with entries in the natural numbers. So the analogous thing for one Hilbert space would be a column vector of complex numbers. So it seems that, in a sense, as you go from one Hilbert space to two Hilbert space, things become simpler. Instead of your vectors being having complex number entries, then you have natural number entries. Okay, so what's a functor between two, a linear functor between two Hilbert spaces? Well, it's just a square matrix, just like a linear map between two Hilbert spaces. Not a square matrix. I don't know why I wrote a square there. is a matrix. Just like a linear map between two finite dimensional one Hilbert spaces. But just as here, the entries aren't complex numbers, but Hilbert spaces, similarly in our matrix, the entries of our matrix aren't complex numbers, but they're Hilbert spaces. But still, you can do matrix multiplication in exactly the usual way. So if we want to apply our functor F to our object X, we treat them as ordinary matrices, but instead of multiplication of complex numbers, we're now the intensive product of Hilbert spaces. And instead of addition of complex numbers, when we apply the matrix multiplication rule, we take the direct sum. But still, that's a perfectly good operation. And then, of course, we have natural transformations between these functors, and now the complex numbers come in. The natural transformations are matrices of complex numbers in a certain sense. I won't describe how that works, but it's just sort of a relatively sort of straightforward thing. So the complex numbers have been pushed down in the category of Hilbert spaces. Right, so this gives you a two category. We have objects, one morphisms and two morphisms, right? Those are the two categories. And the complex numbers only appear at the bottom level. Right, so I think I'm going to skip this because that's nice, but it looks okay. So, an example of the sort of things that happen when you pass from sets to categories, when you use higher dimensional category theory to describe things rather than lower dimensional theory, that things that used to be equal now turn out to only be isomorphic. This is probably something you've all seen before. So this is an awfully important quality here, which we've seen a lot, of course, this week. And we interpret this part here as sort of preparation of entangled state in some sense, in this measurement. And this says that if you do this, then that's equal to doing nothing. We can interpret that as something to do with quantum teleportation. And you can do all this sort of stuff in a setting of two Hilbert spaces. But generally, you don't get an equality, you only get an isomorphism. But that isomorphism itself satisfies a nice, interesting properties. So this is the sort of new structure, this is the sort of totally novel structure that can come in when you calculate. So I'll just time to draw the fancy diagram to explain what that structure is. So this isomorphism, this way to go from the left side to the right hand side, must satisfy the following property. If we start with this, and then we apply the inverse of the isomorphism. We apply the inverse of the more isomorphism here. So we get that. So here we call this isomorphism alpha, here we're applying alpha inverse. And we're going to use the structure of the category to sort of slide this around. Instead we get this. And we'll also have, so that's a cap and a cup being stretched out. There's also one for a cup and a cap, it's called that beta. So here we have a cup and a cap, and we can apply our isomorphism there. We get just back to where we started. And this composite of three things should be the identity. And that is just, in fact, that's just the ordinary equations for adjoint functors sort of appearing in a different sort of way. But what you're seeing here is that what's happening is that we're not saying, this is equal to this. We're saying there is a process that takes you from this to this. And I think that's quite a physical idea, and certainly something that. If you have a good physical understanding of what the physical model that uses two Hilbert spaces, such as these logical field theory, then this idea of there being a physical process that takes you from one side to the other would be a very sort of direct physical interpretable thing.
Jamie, so that I agree that is a good physical interpretation for why to go to higher categories, because this is something operational you can do. You change one operational setup into another one, which actually yields the same result. But how do you know that two Hilbert spaces are the right category to describe that, and not some other higher category?
Right, well, that's a good question. I would say that the reason is that the way I presented them at the moment, they seem very ad hoc. I just sort of said, well, two Hilbert spaces, just loads of copies of the Hilbert space all glued together, and it's a bit silly from that point of view, but in fact, I haven't got time to present the sort of mathematical results, but these two Hilbert spaces satisfy incredibly elegant, in fact, we will see some things. There are incredibly elegant other statements that you can make, but it's certainly very sensitive to the fact that you're using two Hilbert spaces. There are lots of very elegant things that are true, but just simply would not be true if you didn't feel to use some other thing. Right, so that's a mathematical reason to believe that two Hilbert spaces would be the correct structure, just because we can prove these nice results about the mathematics. Sure, people sometimes think about other things. Right. Okay. So we've seen already how we can obtain a two Hilbert space from a group. I think it's kind of a representation. Let's talk about that a little bit. So in particular, we get all representations. We want to take just a finite dimensional unitary complex representation. So we're complex and our morphisms and our representations can be the intertwiners. So why should this be a two Hilbert space? I said that all two Hilbert spaces were just a load of copies of the category Hilbert spaces all stuck together. It's not certainly obvious that should be of this form. But in fact, if you know your Hilbert group theory, there's a famous fact that over the complex number, all representations can be decomposed in a more or less canonical way, not canonical, but about isomorphism, as a sequence of irreducible representations. So so that gives the connection to the way that we've seen two Hilbert spaces described already. So if a group G has n irreducible representations, then the representation category in Hilbert G is just equivalent to Hilbert n. So like I said, these originally were this was the way that people first talked about and described the structure of Hilbert spaces and wanted to study them axiomatically. So I'm now going to talk about choosing a basis for a two-Hilbert space. The objects in a two-Hilbert space, like we've seen, are just given by, so if it's an n-dimensional two-Hilbert space, it's given by n tuples of Hilbert space, the list n spaces. I should have been one Hilbert space. That one Hilbert spaces, as we know, are defined by their dimension, isomorphism. So in the way we've already seen this is particularly the two-dimensional Hilbert space. Its objects just treat them as pairs of natural numbers, the way we've already seen. So if these were one Hilbert spaces, then pairs of complex numbers, there's all sorts of bases we can choose. But if you've only got natural numbers to deal with, so you can do very much. The only other list of bases is 1, 0, and 0, 1. If you're only allowed to have natural numbers of 0 entry, that seems better. But so there's a more elegant way you can look at things, and you'll obtain a slightly more sophisticated notion of bases, but it's a more elegant one. Okay, so let's backtrack a little bit. So this is an observation from Schreiber. How do you choose a basis from one Hilbert space, H? Now what you do is you construct C to the n, a free Hilbert space on set of n elements, and that is a canonical basis. And then you construct an isomorphism between your one Hilbert space, H, and this free Hilbert space, C to the n. And so that explicitly provides you with your basis. Because if you want to know what your basis elements are, you just find each basis element there, you go back along this isomorphism, and it gives you your basis element. So we've explicitly provided basis set for our one Hilbert space. You can do something very similar here, for two Hilbert space, J. Instead of choosing an isomorphism to the space functions on a set, which is an isomorphism to the category of representations of a group point, we've already seen how to define Hilbert G. So in a totally analogous way, we've explicitly provided a basis groupoid to Hilbert space J. So there's a sort of a general theme showing its head here. Except for this funky word super that's going to come in. So there's a slogan that's often very useful. Hilbert space has a set, so there's two Hilbert spaces and a super groupoid. So lots of you probably know what groupoids are, so what a super groupoid is. So we've already seen a shadow of that, because Hilbert spaces have a basis set, two Hilbert spaces seem to have a basis groupoid. Okay, so what's a groupoid? That would be all morphisms from the universe. There's an example of a groupoid. So it's got two objects up to equivalence, but it's certainly perfectly allowable to have two objects, the isomorphic. So this group here, maybe it's a 4 or z2 times z2, and this group is z2, because it's z2 isomorphic. Right, so what's a supergroupoid? Right, so supergroupoids are just groupoids, but where for each object we choose a special arrow, which I've drawn in red, and these arrows must commute with every other arrow on their object. And those must be evolutive, so if you square them you get the identity. And in the case that we have, so often you have quite a free choice to choose these red arrows. So in this case, these objects are connected, and then there's a certain compatibility condition. You can't choose totally independently what your chosen elements are. So that's what supergroupoids are. So that's kind of a funny thing. You can opt for almost all sets of elements, think of them as groupoids. Because, of course, we could just always choose the identity element. And then that's sort of like making a null choice. So every groupoid is a supergroupoid, not to let. Right. So what about, let's get into sort of something nitty-gritty now. So an important part of the mathematics of one Hilbert spaces is the spectral theorem. So let's think about that. Of course, we're just doing this finite dimensionally, but then everything I say does have a more subtle extension to infinite dimensional situations. So what's the spatial thing? Given a finite set, we can check the space functions on that set with the complex numbers. This is a commutative C-star algebra. And every commutative C-star algebra is of this form. So if we have a commutative C-star algebra, we can reconstruct a set explicitly of which the C-star algebra is the algebra functions of. And the analog to this has been known for a very long time, to Dr. Roberts' theorem. And it was discovered by physicists, amazingly. So this really isn't the case of mathematicians inventing some crazy stuff and forcing it down physicists' throats. Right? So this is the Dr. Roberts' theorem. Given a finite supergroupoid sigma, so if you like, you can just forget about the super bit, it's distracting, but this is what makes it technically correct. So given a finite supergroupoid, you can construct a category of functors. So this is just a category of representations. In fact, we should say unitary functors. Unitary representation. And just as you can define a commutative C-star algebra as a vector space with an algebra structure and so on, you can define something called a symmetric 2-C-star algebra, which is not an underlying vector space, but an underlying 2-vector space. And it's not an algebra, it's a monoidal category. It's not commutative, but it's a symmetric monoidal category. So these are sort of obvious extensions of the notion of commutative algebra. And Dr. Roberts showed that every single symmetric 2-C-star algebra is exactly in this form. So if you have a supergroupoid, you can construct one, which is just the category of representations of the supergroupoid, and then the algebra multiplication is the tensor product of representations. But analogously, to the spectral theorem, if you have one of these abstract things, you can reconstruct a supergroupoid of which it is the category of representations. So that's a very important thing in algebra. For example, as opposed to what Rick was talking about.
Jamie, I don't understand where the superstructure is coming in here. I don't see an analogous thing one level lower.
That's why I said hilbert space as a set is two space as a supergroupoids.
I know, but
so supergroupoids are the natural derivatives. The analogous thing one level lower is supergroupoid sets.
I would. All right, we can talk.
Okay. So if you sort of give me a talk where you have plenty of time, then you can go through and you can look at commutative C-star algebras and symmetric 2-C-star algebra, you compare the structure and see how the structure matches up in sort of quite a nice way. But that's a little bit. Here's something back. Okay, so this is a nice big picture. How does this Dr. Roberts theorem work? You have a symmetric 2-C-star algebra. How do you reconstruct the supergroupoid for the representations of it? Well, if we were just doing the ordinary Gelfand spectral theorem, we had our 2-C-star algebra. We would take all of the algebra, the C-star algebra of all things, into the trivial algebra on the complex numbers. There'll be a finite set of those, and those will be exactly the points of our spectrum. We do the precisely analogous thing here. For our C is a monoidal category, it's our symmetric 2-C-star algebra. We take a category, which the objects are all the not the C-star algebra homomorphisms now, but they're the strong monoidal functors, the strong symmetric monoidal functors from our C-star algebra into the category of Hilbert spaces. It's exactly what you do when you use the conventional Gelfand theorem, which is boosted one level up. And there's a beautiful theorem, I forget who it's due to, but actually quite recent. It says if you have two monoidal categories, and you're constructing the functor category from the first and second one. And if the first one has duals, has a compact structure, then all of the natural transformations between these functors are invertible. That's really quite a surprising result, but it's great for us, because it means that the category of functionals on a symmetric C-star algebra, although you think it's only a category, in fact it's a groupoid. Right? So this is how you reconstruct your groupoid. So I think I mistaked that, which would be the invertible things that are monoidal natural transformations. So if you have two monoidal functors, there's a concept of monoidal natural transformation between them. So it's a sort of not much of a leap of faith to define this as the two spectrum of our symmetric 2-C-star algebra. And although here it just looks like it's a groupoid, in fact it's also a supergroupoid. So there's a way to choose some of these arrows to be sort of special, colour them red, like I mentioned before. Don't worry about that. Right, so we're running late anyway, but I'll be shorter than I should just to wrap up. Right, okay, so I'll just present these next few slides. So what about observables? What about the spectral theorem? It seems that, of course, the Gale-Fang theorem is crucial for the way we work with conventional one-Hilbert space quantum mechanics. It allows us to construct a spectrum of an observable as a set, right? If you observe something, it has a set of outcomes, and you construct that set exactly by applying Gale-Fang spectral theorem. And it seems that we have an analog by Dr. Chen Roberts that we can use in this situation. Right, okay, so here's something that we're familiar with doing in case of one Hilbert spaces. We fix a Hilbert space, we choose some basis, depended by some morphism, and we choose some function on that basis, and then we multiply by f in this basis, we have an operator, and of course this will be changed my slide at the last point. So that should be that should say MF dagger equals MF dagger MF. So the operator MF is normal. And of course it's really a fact that every normal operator can be diagonalized, i.e. it can be constructed in this way, which is a basis function, and your normal operator just acts by multiplying in this basis some function. Right? So by the spectral theorem, every normal operator is of this form. Right, so what does this look like when we go one step higher? Well, we do this, and I just think it's a two-Hilbert space. So we're going to make sure that we're trying to construct the sort of analog of a normal operator in this setting. We choose Hilbert, which is a basis. We choose a unitary functor. So this is equivalent to just choosing the function that we're going to multiply with. Here we now choose the functor. Instead of multiplying by our function in the chosen basis, we tensor with our function. Because our function now is a representation, and we tensor with the representation to obtain an endofunctor. So this is the analog of our normal operator. And just as you could show that in the one Hilbert space case, these operators are normal, you can show a weakened thing here as a result that. Sorry, it's very embarrassing. You can dagger there. And but of course, this equal sign is now just an isomorphism. Right. So this MF functor MF will be nullable, a normal functor, but it will be nullable in a sort of weakened sense. Right, so this is the sort of thing that is going to be interesting, whether this is in the two spectral theorem that applies. So you can take any functor MF, such as MF MF dagger equals MF dagger MF, and then just as you do for conventional normal operators, find a basis. In this generalized sense, in which this functor just acts by tensoring my representation of the group, just as we can conventionally get a little normal operator on one of those spaces, like by multiplying my function on a set. So the rest of the talk is really just sort of elaborating on that and having a little chat. We're running a bit late, and the beginning of the talk was about 8 times longer than it was supposed to be. So I think, hey, you look at that, wow, right, okay, so. Right, so okay, this is pretty important. Right. So this is something that is by no means fixed, but I think it's an interesting thing to think about. So every sub-budget operator on one Hilbert space has a spectrum which is a set. But with this is, and we demonstrate this mathematically using the spectral theorem and so on, but it has real physical importance, the set of experimental outcomes. But given the things we talked about earlier, we expect, based on Dr. Roberts' theorem and so on, we expect this to also go through in this new setting, but it's going to have a set of outcomes. We'll have a group, in fact, a supergroup of it, but let's complicate enough to do this, so let's forget the supergroup. So instead of having a set of outcomes, more naturally, we have a group of outcomes. So I think it's interesting to think what this would really mean physically in trying to take this seriously. So a group has both objects and morphisms. Right. So one possible interpretation is that the possible outcomes are represented by the objects, by the elements, but the morphisms correspond to symmetries of the outcomes. So here, this outcome has got four symmetries on it. And these two outcomes are in fact isomorphic to each other. So if you get this outcome or this outcome, maybe that experimentally there's a way to transition from one to the other, right, unlike this one. And also these outcomes have only got a Z2 symmetry, smaller symmetry. And if you then go back to topological quantum field theory, which is the motivation for using this kind of mathematics, and you say, okay, what could this, how could we see this being the natural sort of thing? How could we see that naturally topological quantum field theory you would expect results of measurements to be about group of set? Well, there, the important thing is that you're working very often with a gauge theory. There are certain constructions, so that all of these extended topological quantum field theories can interpret in a certain way that it's a gauge theory. And there, what's important, the fact that it's a gauge theory means that the important physical elements to your theory are looking at if you move around your manifold, how that will induce an action on your state space by some group element. Right. So, an obvious thing you might want to measure is something like the holonomy around. So, if you move around a circle, how does the gauge group act on you? That's something that you ask all the time for a theory. But when you work with quantum field theory, what's just as important as that is looking at the symmetry. So, it's the gauge group gives a symmetry of your physical theory. And it's very, and if two particular ways that if you move around a closed loop, the gauge group could act on you. It's possible that you could have two different ways, but that they should be isomorphic. And when you do quantum field theory, you have to mod out by that equivalent, because it's not physical. But that's exactly what's coming up here. So the sort of an observable you would expect to measure as you measure the holonomy around a closed loop, and there'll be a set of possibilities, which is a group element, but lots of those possibilities will be isomorphic. That's exactly what you get in. So an interesting fact is that quantum gravity in 2+1 dimensions is actually a topological quantum field theory. So you can apply this to things very directly. And Jeffrey Morton's been doing some work directly on that sort of thing. So now I have another example. That's nice, isn't it? Right. But let's just have a summary. Two Hilbert spaces seen from particular perspectives, which is a mathematically rigorous perspective, might be the physically interesting perspective. And fundamental constructions, certainly just as fundamental as one Hilbert space. So then it's a little bit peculiar. So we have this Doppler Roberts theorem that gives us quite a powerful way to generalize the spectral theorem. So there's an obvious way of wanting to generalize talking about spectra of operators and so on. But the familiar topic of quantum theory simply doesn't apply. You know, what method is the relevance of the Copenhagen interpretation and all these sorts of things that we are talking about here? Sort of useful facts that is often a good guide to intuition is that you end up replacing set-like things, like having a basis set or a set of outcomes for an experiment. That would be brutally. You don't have a set of outcomes or a set of basis elements, but they also, rather you do have a set, but there's also symmetries on that set. And so you don't know that's your experience, but I need to talk about that slide, so that's it. Thank you very much.
So, Jamie, can this TQFT picture with this dimensional ladder going down higher, Hilbert spaces going up, is all the structure at the lower levels go down determined by the higher level structure in some sense?
So
it's just sort of telling you about aspects of the level structure.
For a very high, so let's say n is 4, mm-hmm. say, then this is already really far beyond the complexity of what people manage to actually construct. But certainly it would be expected that if you have a fully local TQFT, that there would be many fully local TQFTs, rather, which would differ at these levels So it would be the same thing, but probably sufficiently small value of n. So in fact, if n is if n is 2, that's pretty small. But it's not totally trivial, so we so a closed 2 manifold, we have a complex number. For a closed 1 manifold, we have 1 Hilbert space. But for a closed n minus 2 manifold, which now is 0 manifold, which is a point, we would assign 2 Hilbert space. And it is expected that this can be done in a unit way, or if not a unit way up, sort of up to isomorphism, as often happens. But no, there's certainly no reason that these two levels are so desperately special that in general they'll determine the rest of the structure. It's not expected.
And there are other examples where it's known they don't? Probably.
There are plenty of, so n is 3, then it's 3-dimension 2QFT, there are plenty of 3-dimension 2QFTs just to find at least two levels, and vastly many of those are not local, so they would not be possible to extend them down. But then when you get to n equals 4, it's just so difficult, just with the dealing with high dimensional manifolds.
Another way to represent states on a regular Hilbert space would be not as a vector complex numbers, but if I have a dimension D, I can find a unitary representation of SUD and just ask what the expectation value is of the state.
So you're looking at a symmetry group of the Hilbert space.
Yeah, so I'm thinking you take the trace of rho that is the operator U, G, where U is unitary representation. That gives you a representation of your states. So let's say we just do a pure state. So I could think of it as complex number over the group. It'll have to be a continuous group in this case. So I wonder, is there maybe an analogy between that way of representing a regular Hilbert space and the way you're doing it for two Hilbert spaces?
My gut feeling would be that that way of proceeding wouldn't work very elegantly because if you look at the two-dimensional case, then the group you have there is 2x2 unitary matrices, right? And in the case we have here, the group you have is 2x2 unitary matrices interested in the natural numbers, which is certainly a much less interesting mathematical structure than the group SU2. So immediately I would say, no, that wouldn't work, but then I almost hope that if you think about it, there's some slightly...
Falling the 100 category of the Hilbert
space. Sorry?
But
right, but you just want the unitary ones in a certain size, I suppose.
Which?
So, no, I can't use it to say hello.
Rather than a question, here's a challenge. So, I don't really buy this one, but I do buy the sort of passage from the equality diagram to the. That's a little bit, a little bit stipulated as John Byers as the original motivation for categorification. You go from like equality to process. So, if you take like a derivation of, say, some sort of configuration, some protocol to effectively what it does, you get all these steps in the middle which you write equation. Can you represent them all in this formalism as sort of reconfiguration of all your devices in the lab and then ultimately end up with your overall effect of this configuration? It's something you could attempt to do and see how you can describe all these operational reconfigurations which you actually do in the middle by graphical rewrite. And then this would be very useful if this works.
Well, so something that I think will disappoint you is that I have the opinion that it is not the case that, let's say, we have some conventional complicating systems and some toys, say a qubit or something, and we'll find, we should think of this having a one Hilbert space of states, which have a two Hilbert space of states. And I think that's not, clearly the conventional quantum systems are well described by one categorical quantum mechanics. I'm certainly not saying we should all find ways to model quantum systems in the sense that we are used to understanding them, model them directly using two Hilbert spaces instead of one Hilbert spaces. But what I am saying is that there are physically important, but there are different types of quantum systems which are mathematically important and which are modeled in this way, which are different to the ordinary sort of systems. So I think this picture represents that nicely. If we it's our sort of space of wave functions here that's assigned the one Hilbert space, because these are the space of functions on a space-like slice. So those are the sort of your wave functions, your particles, and those are the one Hilbert spaces. This picture isn't saying don't describe your particle wave functions in Hilbert, describe those two Hilbert spaces. It's not saying that. It's telling you to use two Hilbert spaces for something different, for for another part of your physical theory, and a part of the physical theory that people conventionally you don't consider. Because if you're doing quantum fields, if you're studying quantum field theory, you rarely care about the n-2 dimensional manifolds, for example. So, and that doesn't directly answer your question, but I suppose I'm saying that I don't think that's the point of this. To this end, this is a hazard point. I don't think that is the point.
Typically, you'd expect to find that systems are already modeling inside those,
right,
inside those matrices, those Hilbert spaces that are on.
Right. So these two Hilbert spaces have objects, and your familiar one Hilbert space that describes your system would best be taken as an object inside some large two Hilbert space.
Okay, let's carry the discussion over to lunch.
Okay.